and guided them. They had ridden together, eaten together, slept together, played together, and crossed the Lolo Trail together. Although they could communicate only with the sign language, they had an abundance of shared experiences that drew them together. They had managed to cross communication and cultural barriers to become genuine friends. These affectionate people, our guides, betrayed every emotion of unfeigned regret at separating from us, Lewis wrote. The Nez Perce could not hide their anxiety about their new friends. They said that they were confident that the Pakis, the term probably means enemies, not a specific tribe, would cut us off. As the Indians set off to the north, Lewis and his men headed east. They passed through present-day Missoula, up today's Broadway Street, across the river from the University of Montana. At 5 miles, they came to today's Blackfoot River, called River of the Road to Buffalo by the Nez Perce, coming in from the east and headed up it, through a heavily timbered country of high and rocky mountains. The next day, they made 31 miles. The place they camped that night had been a Hidatsa war party camp a couple of months earlier. On July 6, the Indian sign included fresh tracks along the trail. Lewis was concerned. "They have a large passel of horses," he commented. He expected to meet with either the Hidatsas or another hunting party at any time, so he and the men were much on our guard both day and night. His luck held. There were no encounters with Indians, friendly or hostile. His trip up the Blackfoot River, through one of the most beautiful valleys in Montana, was happily uneventful. What caught Lewis's eye was much sign of beaver in this extensive bottom. On July 7th, the party turned in a more northerly direction to follow the Nez Perce Trail up today's Alice Creek. There were many beaver dams, many deer. Reuben Field wounded a moose. "My dog much worried," Lewis wrote, without giving any detail, but apparently referring to the wounded moose. At about 11 miles, the creek was not much more than a trickle, coming from a spring on the side of a low, untimbered mountain. The trail wound up the north side of the creek, then switched back a couple of times before disappearing over the top of the pass. The trail is plainly evident today, including travoy marks from the thousands of Nez Perce who used it. It can be reached by driving up Alice Creek Road off Montana Highway 200, some 10 miles east of Lincoln, Montana. The pass is called Lewis and Clark Pass, 6,284 feet, somewhat misnamed since Clark never saw it. The party wound its way up the gentle slope. At the top, it reached the dividing ridge between the waters of the Columbia and Missouri rivers. To the east, Lewis could see Square Butte, near the falls of the Missouri, not far from where he stood. The great plains of North America stretched out in front of him, apparently without limit, under an infinity of bright blue sky. He took a step, and he was back in U.S. territory. The descent was easy through hills and hollows. The men could talk only of buffalo, but none were encountered, although tantalizing signs were all about them. The next day, the party crossed the Dearborn River and closed on the Medicine, today's Sun River, where they camped. On July 9th, Joseph Field killed a fat buffalo. "We halted to dine," Lewis wrote. Once they got some roasts going, it commenced to drizzle. That settled it. "I concluded to remain all day," Lewis wrote, and added by way of explanation, "We feasted on the buffalo." He and the men were much rejoiced at finding ourselves in the plains of the Missouri, which abound with game. They surely did. On July 10th, the hunters killed 5 deer, 3 elk, and a bear. They saw herds of buffalo farther down the river. The bellowing of the bulls through the night, it was mating season, kept them awake. It was one continual roar, so loud it frightened the horses. There were vast assemblages of wolves, herds of elk. Lewis and his men had thought they knew how much they missed the plains, but found out they had underestimated. Fresh roasted buffalo hump and tongue tasted even better than they had remembered. Lewis was on his way home, with great discoveries made, and discoveries yet to be made. His stomach was full as it hadn't been since he had left the buffalo country the previous July. He was in a fine, mellow mood, as he showed in the morning when he began his journal with a charming tribute to the great plains of Montana. The morning was fair and the plains looked beautiful, the grass much improved by the late rain. The air was pleasant, and a vast assemblage of little birds which crowded to the groves on the river sung most enchantingly. On the march that day, headed down the Sun River to the Missouri, the party went through a level, beautiful, and extensive high plain covered with immense herds of buffalo. I sincerely believe that there were not less than 10,000 buffalo within a circle of 2 miles. The buffalo provided not only meat, but also coverings for boats. Lewis had 11 of them shot and willow sticks collected to make bull boats, one in the Mandan fashion, the other, on a plan of our own, otherwise unexplained, for crossing the Missouri to the cache on the east bank. In the morning, terrible news. The men sent to round up the horses returned to report that 7 of the 17 were missing. Lewis immediately suspected a hunting party had stolen them. He sent Driard to search for them, although what he thought Driard could do if he caught up with the thieves he did not say. In fact, the order was a mistake, both because of Driard's obvious helplessness in the face of 20 or 30 mounted warriors, and because it deprived Lewis of his sole means of communication with other Indians should they be encountered. After Driard rode off, the horses swam across the river, the bull boats were paddled over, and camp was set up on the site they had occupied during the Great Portage of 1805. The cache was opened. High water during the spring runoff had gotten into it. Lewis's plant specimens were all lost, but fortunately the papers and maps were okay. The loss of the specimens was a terrible blow. They had been collected painstakingly, labeled, carefully dried, requiring daily attention, and preserved. Paul Russell Cutright writes, "Such losses were more than minor catastrophes, resulting as they did in the defeat of prime scientific objectives and the complete vitiation of weeks and months of dedicated effort and inquiry." That night, Lewis found that he had forgotten something else about life on the Missouri River. "Mosquitoes excessively troublesome," he wrote, "insomuch that without the protection of my mosquito beer, I should have found it impossible to write a moment." On July 14th, Lewis had the men prepare the baggage for the upcoming portage. He sent his trunks containing his papers and journals to one of the islands to be put on a scaffold in a thick brush and covered with skins. "I take this precaution," he explained, "lest some Indians may visit the men I leave here before the arrival of the main party and rob them." In the aftermath of losing nearly half of his horses to a roving band of warriors, he was beginning to fear that perhaps he was dividing the Corps of Discovery in too many parts. But his fear was not so strong as to cause him to call off his exploration of the Marias, even though the loss of the horses meant he had to reduce the size of his party from 6 to 3 men. At least that would leave 6 men at the falls, perhaps enough for self-defense. Driard didn't come in that day, which worried Lewis. Nor did he return the following day. Lewis began to fear that a grizzly had killed him. He explained his reasoning. "I knew that if he met with a bear in the plains, even he would attack him, and that if any accident should happen to separate him from his horse in that situation, the chances in favor of his being killed would be as 9 to 10. At 1 o'clock p.m., July 15th, Driard returned. He reported that he had searched for 2 days before discovering where the thieves had run the stolen horses over the Dearborn River. He pursued their tracks, but they had a 2-day start, so he gave it up. He figured the strength of the party at 15 lodges. Lewis assumed it was a hunting party looking for buffalo. He had seen that day how much roving it took to find the herds. There was not a buffalo in sight where the previous day they covered the earth. Such huge herds had to keep moving to find grass, which meant that those who hunted them had to keep moving. Which meant that the Corps of Discovery had been exceedingly lucky the previous year to have avoided all contact with the natives until they got to the Shoshone village. With Driard returned, Lewis was ready to set out in the morning for the Marias exploration. He had selected Driard and the Field brothers. He would take 6 horses, leaving 2 of the best and 2 of the worst with the party at the falls to assist in the portage. He closed his journal, "The mosquitoes continue to infest us in such manner that we can scarcely exist. My dog even howls with the torture he experiences. They are almost insupportable. On July 16th, the exploring party set out, stopping first at the falls where Lewis made a drawing. Then it was out of the river valley and up onto the high plains. To Lewis's eye, the plains have somewhat the appearance of an ocean, not a tree nor a shrub to be seen. He was back in Wonderland. The whole face of the country, as far as the eye can reach, looks like a well-shaved bowling green, in which immense and numerous herds of buffalo were seen feeding, attended by their scarcely less numerous shepherds, the wolves. The enchantment of the place did not prevent Lewis from worrying. His expressed desire to meet the Blackfeet had given way to fear. When he was planning this exploration, he had hoped to have with him some leading Nez Perce men so that he could make a peace between the Nez Perce and the Blackfeet. That motive was now gone. Further, he had planned to explore with a party of 7. Now he was down to 4. Finally, what the Nez Perce said about the Blackfeet, "They are a vicious, lawless, and rather an abandoned set of wretches," had its effect on Lewis. His conclusion, "I wish to avoid an interview with them if possible," because he had no doubt that, finding us weak should they happen to be numerous, the Blackfeet will most probably attempt to rob us of our arms and baggage. He vowed to take every possible precaution to avoid them if possible. The ride through Wonderland continued. On July 18th, we passed immense herds of buffalo. In short, for about 12 miles, it appeared as one herd only, the whole plains being covered with them. Indians never left his mind. At camp that night, on the Marias River, he noted, "I keep a strict lookout every night. I take my tour of watch with the men." For 3 more days, Lewis followed the Marias upstream. On the afternoon of July 21st, the river forked into 2 branches, today's Cut Bank Creek coming from the north, and 2 Medicine River flowing from the south. Since Lewis's whole purpose was to find the northernmost branch of the Marias, he did not hesitate to follow up Cut Bank Creek. But because the Marias had been leading him on an almost straight westward route, he confessed that, "The most northern point, I now fear, will not be as far north as I wished and expected." On Tuesday, July 22nd, Lewis got to within 20 miles of the Rocky Mountains in sight of the Continental Divide in today's Glacier National Park. About 20 miles northwest of the modern town of Cut Bank, he set up camp in a beautiful and extensive bottom of the river, in a clump of large cottonwoods. From the bluff overhanging the bottom, Lewis could see where the creek came out of the mountains, and it was southwest, not northwest, of his position. He had reached the northernmost point of Cut Bank Creek. He decided to stay there for a couple of days, to rest the men and horses and to make celestial observations. "I now have lost all hope of the waters of this river ever extending to north latitude 50 degrees," he admitted, but he was not one to give up easily. "I still hope and think it more than probable that both White Earth River and Milk River extend as far north as latitude 50 degrees. Arlen Large explains his methods and results. Lewis measured the sun's noon altitude on July 23rd, getting a raw octant reading of 62 degrees, 0 feet, 0 inches. He didn't record any conversion of that suspiciously round number into a latitude. Using an 1806 nautical almanac and Lewis's usual method of computation, that octant reading would have produced a latitude of 48 degrees, 10 feet, or some 30 feet too far south. I think it's very possible he didn't compute a latitude here because he wasn't carrying an 1806 almanac. My surmise is that the expedition's 3 almanacs covered 1803, 1804, and 1805 only. His conclusion that Cut Bank Creek didn't reach as high as 50 degrees probably was based on dead reckoning. Using as a benchmark the previous year's calculation of 47 degrees, 25 feet, 17 inches, as the latitude of the Marias-Missouri Junction, he could have seen from his compass courses and distances on the way to Cut Bank Creek that it was well short of the 170-odd miles needed to reach the 50th parallel. What Lewis needed to know was the time, and that he got from his equal altitudes of the sun. He set his chronometer at high noon. If he could make a sextant measurement of a daytime sun-moon distance, he could figure the time in Greenwich. Then he would know his longitude. The following day, Driard returned from a scouting mission to report that there was much sign of Indians in the area. Lewis's attempts to make his observations were frustrated by cloud cover, both that day and the next, and the next. The men went out to hunt without success, a sure sign Indians had been hunting in the area in considerable numbers. The men reported various signs of Indians, some of them large campsites with many, many horses. "We consider ourselves extremely fortunate in not having met with these people," Lewis wrote. He decided he would leave in the morning, July 26th, unless the sun came out so that he could make observations. He was apprehensive that I shall not reach the United States within this season unless I make every exertion in my power, which I shall certainly not omit. The morning of Saturday, July 26th, was cloudy. Lewis waited until 9 o'clock a.m. before giving up, which I do with much reluctance. He had the horses caught, and we set out bidding a lasting adieu to this place, which I now call Camp Disappointment. The party rode south toward Two Medicine River, which it struck around midday. After eating and grazing the horses, the party resumed its march, with Driard ahead in the river bottom, hunting. As the hills closed in on the south bank of the river, Lewis and the Field brothers ascended them to the high plain above, while Driard continued to ride down the valley. When Lewis got to the top and looked about, he was alarmed to see, at the distance of a mile or so, a herd of 30 horses. He brought out his telescope and discovered several Indians sitting their horses, staring intently into the valley. Lewis surmised they were watching Driard. "This was a very unpleasant sight," Lewis admitted. If there were as many Indians as there were horses, which he assumed would be the case, he was overwhelmingly outnumbered. He thought they were Atsinas or Blackfeet. In either case, from their known character, I expected that we were to have some difficulty with them. He thought of flight and immediately gave it up. To run was to invite pursuit, and the Indians' horses looked better than his. Further, if he and the Field brothers ran, Driard would most probably fall a sacrifice. Lewis resolved to make the best of our situation. He ordered Joseph Field to display the flag which Lewis had brought for just this purpose. When it was unfurled, the party advanced slowly on the Indians, who were running about in a very confused manner as if much alarmed. Suddenly, a single Indian broke out of the milling pack and whipped his horse full speed toward the party. He was probably on a dare trying to count coop. Lewis dismounted and stood, waiting for the onrushing horse and rider. The Indian was disarmed by Lewis's reaction. He halted some 100 yards from the party. Lewis held out his hand. The Indian wheeled his horse around, gave it the whip, and galloped back to his companions. Lewis could count them by now. There were 8 teenage boys and young men. He suspected there were others hidden behind the bluffs, for there were several other horses saddled. He ordered the Field brothers to advance with him slowly. His heart pounded. His life and the lives of his men were at stake. So were his papers, dearer to him even than his life. He told the Field brothers that no matter how many Indians there were, he was resolved to resist to the last extremity, preferring death to being deprived of my papers, instruments, and gun. He hoped they would form the same resolution. When they nodded a grim-faced assent, Lewis told them to be alert and on their guard. James Rhonda writes that Lewis's words were filled with more swagger than wisdom. There is a bit of melodrama in this mutual pledge to fight to the last breath, and asking the Field brothers to swear was hardly necessary. It was not as if they had a lot of choice. If the Indians wanted to fight, there would be a fight. This was the pickle Lewis's leadership had brought them to. 4 men alone, and one of them separated from the rest, in the heart of Blackfoot country, had run into a roving band of young Indian braves. 2 parties of armed young men, each suspicious of the other, were attempting to occupy the same space at the same time. That always meant trouble. The Red War Party outnumbered the White War Party by at least 2-1, and possibly much more. The natives figured to have reinforcements close at hand. The whites had no reinforcements within 200 miles. It was Lewis's fault. He was the one who had dreamed up this exploration, the one who had decided to make it with a party of four only, the one who had delayed 2 full days at Camp Disappointment, even though he knew that every additional hour in Blackfoot Country raised the risks of an unwelcome encounter and that Clark would soon be waiting for him at the Yellowstone, and even though he wanted to get back to St. Louis as soon as possible. But there were positive possibilities in the situation. If a friendly, or at least a non-violent, initial contact could be made, Lewis would have a chance to bring these Indians into the American trading empire. That would justify the risks he had taken. When he got to within 100 yards of the Indians, Lewis had the Field brothers stop while he advanced singly to meet an Indian who had ridden out ahead of his group. The two men met and cautiously shook hands. Then both passed on to shake hands with the others in their respective parties. Lewis dismounted. So did the Indians, who asked for pipes and smoke. Using his limited sign language skills, Lewis told them that the pipe was with his hunter, down below in the valley. He proposed that an Indian ride down with Reuben Field to find Driard and bring him back. This was done. Lewis asked who they were. He thought they replied that they were Atsinas, a tribe known to Lewis as the Minotaurs of the North. Actually, they were Piegans, members of one of the 3 main divisions of the Blackfeet. Lewis asked who was the chief. 3 men stepped forward. Lewis thought they were too young and too many to be chiefs, but he also thought it best to please them. He handed out a medal, a flag, and a handkerchief. By now, Lewis had concluded that there